You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of February 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House. We're live from Studio One here at Monocle 24. I'm Ted Kravitz. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, how Mexico is enjoying a tourist boom despite its well-publicised crime wave. Monocle's business editor Jonathan Openshaw is here to run through the week's entrepreneurial events. As London's ICA kicks off its Japanese film festival, we find out how the genre is now much more than just sex, horror and anime. And we'll be joined in the studio by the author of Geek Nation, how Indian science is taking over the world. All that, plus our edit of the best music around and the latest news and weather, right here on Midori House, live on Monocle 24. And with that latest news from around the world, here's Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News, a Portuguese economy professor, André Silva, has said that Moody's decision to downgrade Portugal's credit ratings has made it even more difficult for the government to solve the country's finances in order to meet the expectations of the European Union and the International Monetary Fund.
So the government needs to fulfill its responsibilities, its obligations, and for that the government asks for money from the public in the form of taxes and also in the form of debt. And a downgrade like that makes it much more difficult for the government to finance itself.
Moody's downgraded Portugal and another five Eurozone nations, including Spain and Italy, on Monday. It also warned that it might cut the AAA ratings of the United Kingdom, France and Austria. Vice President Joe Biden's pledged to tackle US-China differences head-on as he welcomed Beijing's leader-in-waiting Xi Jinping for talks today that could set the tone for relations between the two rival powers over the next decade. Xi's White House visit was the centrepiece of a US trip that could help the Chinese vice president boost his international standing and show he's capable of steering his country's crucial relationship with Washington.
We are not always going to see eye to eye. We're not always going to see things exactly the same. But we have very important economic and political concerns that warrant we work together.
Xi's visit comes at a time when ties between Beijing and Washington have been buffeted by strains over trade, currency, human rights and military intentions. The team of doctors arriving today at the prison where former Ukrainian Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko is serving her seven-year sentence after being found guilty of office abuse in 2011. At the behest of her family, the medical team, including three doctors from Canada and two from Germany, arrived to the jail in the city of Kharkiv, some 300 miles from the capital Kiev. They agreed to visit her to carry out an independent examination of her. This Canadian doctor said it was important to think of the patient and her needs.
It's a difficult problem, and we hope to, in the spirit of cooperation with our patient, do the very best for our patient.
Here in the UK, Catherine, the Duchess of Cambridge, has brought smiles to sick children's faces in Liverpool as she toured a hospital and charity which provides a home away from home for families of recovering youngsters. She's spending Valentine's Day alone as Prince William is on exercises in the Falkland Islands as a search and rescue pilot. It was revealed in the press that he'd sent her flowers and a card and that the couple have a new puppy to keep Kate company whilst her husband is away, but the Cocker Spaniel's name is being kept under wraps by the couple. However, one young patient Kate talked to at the hospital was privileged to be told the royal secret.
It was really good meeting her. She was really friendly and she asked me about how I'm doing and what I've been through. And she also told me about her dog. Told me it was a black Cocker Spaniel.
Elliot Casey added that Kate has told him the dog's name, but he's promised to keep it secret. And staying with the Valentine theme, finally, young Iranians have abandoned thoughts of sanctions, nuclear power and economic hardship today in favour of shopping for gifts and making dinner plans to celebrate love on Valentine's Day. This is despite rising tensions with the West over its nuclear ambitions. Many Tehran restaurants were fully booked and young Iranians could be seen out browsing gift shops in the capital to buy presents for loved ones in defiance of a ban on Valentine's Day items aimed at preventing the spread of so-called Western culture. And those are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And it is now 5 minutes past the hour here on Midori House. Now, no longer Valentine's Day in Australasia. It is indeed February the 15th. And we have a couple of papers in with some interesting stories on here. I don't know if you've seen the Julia Gillard story. All sorts of machinations. A few weeks ago, one of her deputies was sacked after tipping off the press as to the whereabouts of some opportunist people who are her political enemies. And now the headline is Gillard used polling to trigger coup. More details of the removal of Kevin Rudd, which was the person that she took over from a couple of years ago. In the days before challenging Kevin Rudd for the prime ministership, apparently, says the Sydney Morning Herald, Julia Gillard personally handed her Labour colleagues copies of secret internal polling designed to undermine his leadership. This is despite her saying that she had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, she was very good at claiming that she was the innocent person, that she just happened to be the catalyst. But of course, now you've just discovered this secret plan about what she really was up to. Mm. Unbelievable, really, isn't it?
Yes, and I don't know if you've seen the picture on the front of it. Photographers will always find a way of making a slightly more sinister shot out of what is just a normal sort of speech to some people. But putting Julia Gillard in silhouette rather makes that shot on there. And turning from Australia to New Zealand, finally, we have, here we go, Wednesday, February the 15th, The Press, which leads on a Kiwi MP who is being refused money for an electronic device which will make her hear. She's a deaf MP and something more than just sign language. She's being refused the $30,000 for electric note-taking technology. And news that house prices in Christchurch are on the rise. And the New Zealand Herald has a story on the side saying, "Our worst summer." And another photoshopped picture of the girl on the beach, and they photoshopped in some dark clouds and rain. But apparently that is the temperature there at the moment. For the headline temperature for Wednesday is rain and only 19 degrees. And for that coming just out of their summer doesn't bode particularly well. So the weather making the front page of the New Zealand Herald. Right, talking of weather, here's Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
And first up, Europe. In the UK and France, temperatures have increased quite significantly this Valentine's Day. In fact, by tomorrow, Wednesday, even as far east as the German-Polish border, daytime highs will be around or just above zero. Compare that to minus 10 just a few days ago. However, Central Europe will be getting some heavy snow. Be prepared for the possibility of flight delays at airports in some parts of Germany, Switzerland, Poland, and other neighbouring countries as well. Here's Wednesday's city outlook. In London, 10 degrees and some sunshine. In Brussels, 6 and rain. Berlin, plus 1, snow and quite windy. In Stockholm, 0 degrees, some snow here too. North America, a snowy Valentine's Day across the upper Midwest of the US and some winter weather for Chicago, Detroit, Indianapolis. Not a lot of snow, around 5 to 10 centimetres at most. On the Atlantic coast for Long Island, the weather will be changeable, a mix of sun and rain for the rest of the week. Here's Wednesday's city outlook. In Montreal, 0 degrees with snow flurries. In New York, 11 degrees and rain. Las Vegas, 13 and sunny. In Los Angeles, around 15 with sun and showers. Some holiday destinations the next few days. Here's the Caribbean. In Barbados, around 28 degrees. In Bridgetown here, the water temperature, a fresh 26 degrees, about the average. St. Lucia and Dominica, around 29 degrees. And in all these locations, sunshine and passing thunderstorms, especially in Barbados. How about South Africa in Cape Town? Sunny skies here all week and 26 degrees. But in Johannesburg, thunder showers. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thomas, thank you very much for that. 9 minutes past the hour, and in a moment we're going to be talking about the burgeoning Mexican tourist industry. Stay with us.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e o cosa?
Tama on Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House, live from Studio One at Monocle HQ. Now, seldom a week goes by without news of more violent crime and murder on the streets of Mexico's towns and cities. Despite this gang drug war, tourism in Mexico is on the up. According to new figures released by the Mexican Tourist Ministry, last year air passengers travelling to the country increased by 2% higher than the previous year. While visitor numbers from the US have remained constant, so we're led to believe, the rise apparently is coming from emerging tourist nations such as Brazil, Russia, Peru and China, lured to Mexico's ancient ruins and blue seas by affordable prices. Well, we're now joined in the studio by Manuel Diaz, Mexican Tourist Board Regional Director for Europe. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And speaking as somebody who made a trip to Mexico in about a year ago, is this true? Are figures genuinely on the rise? And are they figures...
Even better than what you have mentioned before, actually. We increased
11%. 11%?
Compared to 2010.
Now, are these to the tourist places or are these to the places like DF, Mexico City?
It's in general. It's obviously... is in the first place is Yucatan Peninsula, Cancun, yeah. Second Mexico City, Puerto Vallarta, and Los Cabos. And obviously other places, but mainly these four regions.
So we should say, first of all, that places that we hear about on the news, gang trouble, crime, things like that, these are happening in places like Ciudad Juarez. People aren't going there for tourism, are they?
No, definitely. It's not an area where actually, it's not a touristic, has never been a touristic area. Was a very important city for manufacture, still is. But obviously, as you mentioned, is not precisely a focal point for Europeans, tourism-related.
So really, the point is that people aren't being put off by some of the stories they see in the news.
No, actually, the situation or the stories that you mentioned hasn't stopped the figures to grow. To our surprise and obviously to our enjoyment.
No, I was going to ask you. I mean, are you surprised? Because, you know, as we said, sometimes a day doesn't go by. You see some stories of, you know, horrific things.
I know. And actually, I wouldn't say it is not true because obviously it's been on the newspapers. But one thing is narcotraffic is obviously among narcotraffickers and the crime has been among them. Until today, hasn't been a serious attack on civilians or private properties. It's really very focalized on certain areas, and actually the killings have been among themselves. Mm. That's very important. Unless you are involved on that industry, you could be safe or really in danger. Mm. And that's it, actually. I think there are other problems like terrorism that could be more dangerous because it's on civilians and public areas. Mm. And this is not the case of Mexico.
So before we talk about where people are going to places like Cancun, as you say, and the reasons behind that, let's talk about DF, as you call it, Mexico City, as the rest of us do. You do have to take some kind of general sort of city-wide precautions, though, as you would in any city. I think you'd accept that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, Mexico City, but it's a funny. Mexico City has become one of the most important icons of cities for the urban tourism, in not only in the world, but obviously in Latin America. It's a city full of contrasts. It's a city that has been always had a reputation of chaotic, polluted, but it's so funny now. It's actually a city full of culture. Mm. It's a city full of energy. A great vibe, a great nightlife, great food. It's now one of the most popular spots after Cancun in Mexico, and very safe in a way.
Mm. I mean, there are some streets. I went to Oaxaca. Took me a while to learn to pronounce it in the first place. And I did find myself strolling through some neighbourhoods, some less well-off neighbourhoods, away from the central tourist area. Mm-hmm. And I thought, mm-hmm. sometimes I got the feeling, maybe I shouldn't be here or just be careful or something. But do you think there's an element that people can make themselves vulnerable, make themselves victims sometimes?
Remember, actually, even in London, if you go to certain areas, you feel the same. And with more reason in countries in Latin America, you go to certain poor areas where you could feel unsafe. But to be honest, sometimes in these areas, this is where people are more gentle and friendly.
Yes, no, I mean, certainly nothing happened to me, despite a few margaritas. But if we move on to... actually, there was a particularly good cocktail with the... I'll tell you about it later.
Mezcal Pauling Oaxaca.
It was, yeah. Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. Let's talk about where the tourists are going to. There was a new flight from the UK, at least, launched between London and Cancun.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of people are going south along that long beach to Tulum and places like that to see. How important was that direct flight? Because previously, I don't think you could go to Cancun from there.
Very important. Let me tell you, obviously, Cancun has got a bad reputation, unfairly a bad reputation, because Cancun, in a way, is a Mayan world. Cancun is actually the gate to the Mayan world. Sorry, Cancun is a Mayan world. And obviously, we needed to have direct flights from the United Kingdom to Cancun in order to increase actually the level of, the image of the destination. The fact that the British Airways is flying again to Cancun, and Virgin is going to fly for the first time to Mexico, specifically Cancun, this year, has been fantastic for us. It's going to obviously improve the level of confidence and the level of tourism visiting the area. Why? Because our commercial flights. Mm. Even though we had the most amazing all-inclusive services in the whole area, we have a very sophisticated infrastructure. And on top of that, and as important, Mexico is a cultural destination. And with the Mayan end of the world, which is actually not the end of the world, it's a change of an era, is the time this year to reposition Mexico, specifically that area, as a cultural destination due to the Mayan heritage. Mm.
Okay, well, you mentioned Cancun being some of the destinations for the American teenagers. Does that still happen, or is that just an urban
name? Not really. It was very important for the spring breakers, but not anymore, or not as much as before, because most of the properties are not the level, or hasn't got the price that the spring breakers could pay. Believe it or not, after Vilma in 2006, Cancun was revamped, and most of the hotels are not as cheap as they used to be for this kind of tours, which is, any kind of tourist is a business. Mm. But this was more than a business, was a risk, and it was actually a kind of expensive one for us.
So tell us, finally, Manuel, about these new tourists coming in from Brazil, from Peru, and also from China. Tell us, is this correct? Have you seen Chinese tourists?
Yeah, we decided 2 years ago to really diversify the promotional activities, and actually in order to diversify the market. Yes, we have the main markets for Mexico have been always the US, Canada, and obviously Europe. The UK is the number one for Europe, and there's a third one worldwide. But we started promoting Mexico and actually Moscow, Arab Emirates, China, and Japan, where we have offices. And the results have been fantastic. We had new capacity from those countries, and we had the emerging markets, including Brazil, Argentina, Colombia, and Venezuela, that have grown enormously. I mean, Brazil and Moscow, they have shown figures that are unbelievable.
Mm. Okay, well, that's absolutely fascinating. So you would say to anyone considering going, I mean, I'm sure you would say this, but yes, there are problems. You're unlikely to be involved.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
but just bear in mind what's going on. What would the advice be?
Well, what you got to consider actually is that nowadays there are so many dangerous places. Many dangerous places. Actually, Mexico is a safe destination. It's obviously you have to be responsible when you travel, but actually the situation is not bad. And actually, the message that these new flights, specifically on Sirius Airlines, as well as new exhibitions, we just closed the most important luxury exhibition is going to take place in Mexico this year, ILTM, and all these new ventures from foreign companies are a huge message that Mexico is safe. What I say is that visit Mexico is still very, very safe, but just obviously be responsible as you could be or you have to be when you travel anywhere in the world.
Indeed. Okay. Well, just final words is to watch out for the mezcal cocktails.
Well, I actually enjoy them.
No, you will do. Okay, thank you very much for joining us. That's Manuel Diaz.
Thank you for having me.
The Regional Director for Europe for the Mexican Tourism Board. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We'll be back in just a moment.
Monocle Films, the cinematic eye on the world that brings you crafted stories from affairs to business, culture to design. Plus, our weekly Monocle briefings featuring original concepts in travel and retail. Premiering this week, high-performance innovation from the biggest sporting goods trade fair in the world.
There's a real nice vibe for almost what we're calling gentleman explorer. Those people who used to go to the Arctic in just a jumper and an extra pair of socks and that beautiful styling coming through. So, yeah, some really nice heritage product.
You can find this and over 400 more films on monocle.com.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop-in-shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Past the hour here on Midori House. Just still discussing tequila recipes and margarita ideas with Manuel here. But let's go for some music. And after that, we're going to have Jonathan Openshaw, our business editor. This is Marlena Shaw with Mercy Mercy. Mercy, mercy, Marlena Shaw here on Midori House, live on Monocle 24. Now, every day around this time, we're joined by one of Monocle magazine's section editors. Joining me today is Monocle's business editor, Jonathan Openshaw. Hi, Jonathan. Now, business on a Tuesday.
Yes. Sorry, I had to chuck Manuel out of the studio. I think you could have done an hour on Mexico alone, couldn't you?
Well, we did come up with an excellent new business idea based around the humble tostada, sort of a large circular version of the tortilla chip.
But it could be one for the entrepreneur show.
Yes.
We'll have to sort details.
I've been trying to get it going. I just need to find someone to make them, someone to market them, and then people to buy them. Apart from that, the idea's all there. Now, LVMH, Louis Vuitton Moet Hennessy.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Okay, so maybe slightly less, well, maybe not less glamorous than Ted's Tostadas, but anyway. So this is picking up on, you know, a story we're very familiar with, the Chinese luxury market. Mm. You know, everyone's been watching it. The growth by groups like LVMH or Richemont's been double figures into China. And also, you know, high profile buyouts by groups like Fung Group into Europe coming in and buying things like Delvaux. But, you know, the assumption's always been that China can consume luxury, but it can't produce it. And it's always been, you know, we've looked at how the Chinese can either, like, they can run a European franchise, or they can buy a European brand, or they can make a knockoff of a European brand, but they don't create kind of indigenous luxury. Well, this may all be changing, because reported in the Wall Street Journal yesterday was a relatively big investment by L Capital Asia, which is a private equity fund backed by the French luxury giant LVMH. And it's bought a stake in Chinese casual wear company Trendy International.
Great name.
I know. But don't be put off by the name. This could be a pretty major shift in the balance of power. It's kind of highlighting the rise of the Chinese homegrown fashion. Mm. I mean, I think it's actually one of the fastest growing apparel markets in the world. Domestic Chinese brands. So
Trendy International, probably, and their suppliers, they're already making this stuff for these people anyway. For many so-called luxury brands, are made. Shanghai, Beijing, I mean, Guangzhou, exactly. A lot of them are made down there.
Yeah, very much so. But this is starting to see a slight shift in made in China, but, well, you know, with an Italian stamp on it, a French stamp on it. But now it's looking at actual domestic Chinese consumer-facing brands, which is it's a subtle but important shift. And, you know, the deal is, the rumoured amount is it's $200 million they're looking at for roughly a 10% stake. It's a sizable investment. I mean, if you compare it to something like the deal that LVMH did for Bulgari last year, which was 3.7 million euros, it's not quite up on that level, but it's definitely a serious kind of statement of intent in the market.
And how do you think it will go down amongst the newly moneyed Chinese who really don't want to buy Chinese a lot of the time?
Well, this is the problem: is that made in China for a lot of these people, for the newly affluent, it's not a sign of it's not a sign of luxury goods. I mean, unless it's something like jade or silk, where there's like proven competencies, it's not. So it is. I mean, this is the market that's eating up brands like Zegna. They've got a lot of room for Italian luxury, but they're not necessarily sympathetic to Chinese luxury yet. I think it's more looking ahead to the future. It's looking at how the luxury market in China might develop as it goes on. Luxury is obviously it's all about brand. It's all about heritage. Mm. So this is very much saying that, you know, it's not China won't just be importing European luxury forever. There are potentially some homegrown offers on the horizon.
And that leads us onto our second Chinese story, because, you know, you would imagine that a giant like LVMH would have done this kind of big deal in China a long time ago, 2012, and they're just getting this done. A lot of money, as you just said, shows that there's obviously growth in it. But that leads us on, what are you going to tell us about our second story, and towards Italy, is that right? Italian involvement?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, you're right to say that the market in China is really the one to watch. It's said that I think China is going to be account for something like 30% of the global fashion market in the next 5 years.
Is it the only area of growth? For luxury goods?
No.
Real growth only?
Well, we're very much looking at the brick markets generally. Yeah. So you've got very sophisticated markets in Brazil. You've got budging markets in China and India. Mm. China's the place to watch. But yeah, the other story that I wanted to highlight is one that we'll actually probably be covering in Monocle, because it is an interesting one. It's with a brand that we've worked with quite a lot, Caruso in Italy. And recently their CEO, Raffaello Caruso, was over in Beijing last October to give a talk on kind of made in Italy, brand Italy. And his proposition was, instead of a fake Italian brand made in China, then the best thing is a real Chinese brand made in Italy. Mm. Off the back of this, China Garments, which is a state-owned apparel maker, and they've got products that range from kind of Mao suits to military riot gear. They've unveiled plans for the launch of what's being billed as China's first luxury men's apparel brand. It's going to be specifically aimed at domestic consumers, not aimed at the international market. So this is a Chinese brand to appeal to Chinese chaps. And so the brand's going to be called, my pronunciation is going to be awful, but Sughere, I think, from the Italian word to rise. And also we'll have the pinyin, the Chinese characters Shiji, which means nation. Hmm. So yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting proposition. It's the first time that we've seen this reverse trend where it's taking, you know, a Chinese consumer-facing brand and putting made in Italy on it and accruing all the benefits that you get from having made in Italy and rejecting that kind of outsourced version of made in China for an Italian brand.
Mm. Okay, well, we're heading very quickly towards the news headlines. So I just wanted to say that they might be missing a trick there, not selling it in, they could sell it in Europe and make it a unique brand.
Well, it's absolutely,
you know, we buy Japanese here and like to think that there's something, you've got something that everybody won't have in Europe.
It's going to be a global proposition. It's going global. It's the first, it's like I said, it's being billed as the first men's brand from China that can go global.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's exciting. It could be a big one.
Okay, brilliant. Well, thank you very much for that. That's Monocle's business editor, Jonathan Openshaw, with the latest from China. You're listening to Midori House. As I say, the headlines are next.
LDN TYO. NYC MT4.
And sorry we're a little late with this. 31 minutes past the hour here on Midori House, and it's the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Thanks very much. A Portuguese economy professor, André Silva, has said that Moody's decision to downgrade Portugal's credit ratings has made it even more difficult for the government to solve the country's finances in order to meet the expectations of the European Union and the IMF. Moody's downgraded Portugal and another five Eurozone nations, including Spain and the UK, Spain and Italy, and they also warned they might cut the AAA ratings of the UK, France and Austria. Vice President Joe Biden has pledged to tackle US-China differences head-on as he welcomed Beijing's leader-in-waiting Xi Jinping for talks today that could set the tone for relations between the two rival powers over the next decade. Xi's White House visit was the centrepiece of a US trip that could help the Chinese vice president boost his international standing and show he is capable of steering his country's crucial relationship with Washington. The team of doctors arriving today at the prison where former Ukrainian Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko is serving her seven-year sentence after being found guilty of office abuse last year. At the behest of her family, the medical team, including three doctors from Canada and two from Germany, arrived at the jail some 300 miles from the capital, Kiev. They agreed to visit her to carry out an independent examination. Here in the UK, Catherine, the Duchess of Cambridge, has brought smiles to sick children's faces in Liverpool as she toured a hospital and charity which provides a home away from home for families of recovering youngsters. At Ronald McDonald House, which provides accommodation so families can stay near their ill children, Kate chatted to parents and staff and made sure to emulate Diana, the Princess of Wales's habit of bending down to talk to children directly. And on a Valentine's Day theme, would you believe it, young Iranians have abandoned thoughts of sanctions, nuclear power and economic hardship today in favour of shopping for gifts and making dinner plans to celebrate love on Valentine's Day. Very surprising. Many Tehran restaurants were fully booked and young Iranians could be seen out browsing gift shops in the capital to buy presents for loved ones in defiance of a ban on Valentine's Day items aimed at preventing the so-called spread of Western culture. And those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much. Now, still to come in the next half hour here on Midori House, we'll be finding out how India is staking its real claim as the new world leader in scientific research and technology. But first, back to 1992, Vanessa Paradis and Be My Baby. Seven minutes past the hour, Vanessa Paradis and Be My Baby. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, our next studio guest may have you believe that India is becoming a nation of science and maths geeks. From medical and dental graduates to science and engineering doctorates, Indians are now the growing force in the world. By the turn of the millennium, there are even claims that a third of all engineers in Silicon Valley were of Indian origin, with Indians reportedly running 750 of the tech companies in that area. Well, the book Geek Nation has just been published in paperback, and it meets the inventors, engineers and young scientists helping India become the world's next scientific superpower. And I'm delighted to say the author, Angela Saini, is with us in the studio. Angela, how Indian science is taking over the world? Really, I doubt you'll find many people who disagree with that at the moment.
Well, you mean agree with that?
Who would disagree that it
disagree
that
it's taking over the
that it
well,
is,
actually, I had
is
a lot
taking
of,
over the world.
I had a lot of problems with that subtitle. It wasn't my invention. The marketing team at Hodder came up with that, and the reason was
do you disagree with it?
Well, you know, the book is quite sceptical. So even when I was starting out on the journey, I thought, you know, as a science journalist, you read journals and you look at what research is coming out, and very little research actually comes out of India, significant research. They don't have loads of Nobel Prize winners. So I was sceptical to begin with, and there is certainly lots of reason to be sceptical as well when you're travelling through India. But it ends on a cheerful note because there are these wonderful shoots of innovation and this wonderful young generation of scientists and engineers who want to work in India, stay in India, and build it up into a scientific superpower. So it's not there yet, but I think it will be.
Now, there's an interesting thing you just said there. Work in India, stay in India. Because plenty don't. Plenty want to leave India and spread this wherever they can get work around the world.
Yeah, of course. And my dad was one. My dad was a chemical engineer in India in the 1960s. And that was a time when India had huge unemployment. In fact, when he was a student, he used to protest with his student friends against unemployment, mass unemployment, much as we do now in London. And he came to Britain because there just weren't the big jobs there that people like him wanted. And at that time, Silicon Valley was growing and Britain was the place to come if you wanted to be an engineer. It's interesting to see how much that has changed, because even now when I give talks, there are students coming to me, young scientists and engineers, saying, we're thinking of going to Asia to work.
Now, is that because that industry didn't exist 20, 30, 40 years ago, and now it does, despite it being in, well, it's not really in its infancy, is it? But it's still on the rise.
Well, it's about a trajectory. So back then, you know, Britain was a mighty force in engineering, and the US was the most exciting place to be in the world if you were a scientist or an engineer. And India didn't, even though it had some brilliant labs that had been there for decades, it didn't really have that much to offer the most talented scientists and engineers. You can see that reversing already. So in the UK, for example, science funding is going down in real terms, whereas in India, they're ramping it up at a level that's unprecedented.
Did that surprise you? And what else surprised you writing this book?
Lots of things surprised me. I mean, the book is a travelogue. So I visit the scientists and engineers and geeky people who I think are trying to build into India into this big superpower that it wants to be. It's not... I had a choice. Either I could look at fundamental research, which is very important, or I could look at applied research and technology. And I went the applied route because that's where India is making the biggest inroads in terms of changing the lives of ordinary people. So I look at how science is changing agriculture, how it's changing forensic science in India. There are lots of different spheres, public spheres, in which science is having a huge impact.
Now, you say this geeky word and you look at this, but you know, kids are born, they go to school, they're not all geeks. It's just an avenue that they're going down. But this is something that you discovered, you identified, you thought actually, or it's just a catch-all phrase for people who like maths and physics and chemistry.
Well, India produces 1 million science and engineering graduates every year. There is a love of science and engineering that I have not seen anywhere else. I studied engineering in this country. And when I go to India and I tell people I have an engineering degree, it means everything to them. They cannot understand why I became a journalist when I had an engineering degree. Because to them, it's like being a rock star. Being a top engineer is like being a rock star.
How does that square with, let's just say, street life in some of India's big cities?
You mean every day, what it looks like?
No, just more about the, you know, engineering and science is all about order and logic and...
Not necessarily.
And then
I mean, for me, geekiness, there are lots of ways you can define it. You'd have to be a real geek to go out of your way to define it very precisely. But I would say it's about being intellectual and being passionate. So engineers, when they're being geeky, are throwing things all over the place and building things and making a mess. So it's not necessarily about order. You know, scientists might be different. To me, you can see evidence of Indian creativity and scientific ingenuity everywhere you go. There's actually a phrase called jugaad in Hindi, which means tinkering and making the best of a bad job. And in the science and technology sense, you can see it everywhere. You can see people who've made trucks out of bits of leftover wood and an old tractor. You can see tiny bit. You go to little villages and you go to street markets and you see things that people have cobbled together. There are amateur engineers everywhere.
Well, this is my point, because, yes, and you see the chaos of what's going on the streets, and people making these devices, as you say, sometimes doesn't fit in with maybe, Indian graduates will go and work in the States and Silicon Valley, and these are all clinical, clean facilities with people wearing white coats and gloves.
Well, you do have both. So if you go to Bangalore, there are parts of it that feel like Silicon Valley. Mm. If you go to Electronic City in Bangalore, it really does. But real science is messy. The history of science shows that it's messy. In the 17th century and 18th century, at the birth of modern science, you had people blowing things up, killing themselves, trying to do research. And creativity is not a clean process, even though the act of doing research, actual, you know, high-level research, may happen in a lab where everything needs to be very clean. But, you know, creativity and the creative part of science is much messier than that.
Okay, well, another creative industry is... sports, and I think there is, you just told me there's a chapter in here. An Indian boy growing up, maybe a girl, but we haven't quite reached that stage yet, might think, okay, I want to be Sachin Tendulkar. You know, I want to be the world's most famous cricketer. That is the passion as far as sport goes. Did you find that actually little boys want to be that rather than engineers?
There are lots of little boys that want to be cricket players, cricket stars. But there are lots of people who want to be engineers. And I would say the number who want to be engineers probably outnumber the numbers who want to be cricketers. Just because engineering is thought to be such a wonderful profession. And it's an accessible route for people now, for young people, that is a way to lift themselves out of poverty. You see, I mean, for example, the Indian Institutes of Technology, these are the elite engineering colleges of India. There's only a handful of them. They only take 10,000 students a year. 500,000 students apply.
Wow. Yeah. So what are you thinking of? Obviously, the book, it's called Geek Nation. It's, as you say, published by Hodder, out in paperback at the moment. Are you? Has it put you on to any other ideas along the trend? Have you thought of something else, looking into what's your next project?
Well, I would like to write another book. I'm just thinking of some ideas at the moment. But one thing I do want to get across is that, you know, for people who haven't read it and they have a look at the paperback cover is quite funky compared to the hardback, but they look at the cover and they think, wait a second, this can't be true. Indian science cannot be taking over the world. And I would say read it so that you understand a balanced picture. So there are stories in there that try and explain the dangers of a scientific society just as much as the positive aspects. So there's one story, for example, on a mind-reading machine. So forensic labs all across the country now have bought into this new technology invented by this maverick scientist, which is based on an EEG. And he claims, through software plugged into this EEG, that he can tell you whether criminal suspects are telling the truth or not. So it's kind of a very sophisticated polygraph, but pretty much just as accurate as a polygraph, so not very reliable at all. And it's one example of quite a few, actually, of a society that's so enthralled to science that sometimes it loses its way a little. And all societies do it. I just want to make that clear. America did exactly the same with the polygraph in the 1960s and 1970s. In the 1970s, you couldn't apply for a government job in the US without them running a polygraph test on you. And now that India is entering this kind of very pro-science, very pro-big science era, in which science cannot do wrong, and everything is thought to have some kind of technological fix, there are some dangers and risks.
Mm. Indeed, yes. Okay, well, it sounds fascinating. I think all of us at times in our lives would like to know what other people are thinking, but I think it's probably best some things are left unknown in that area. But let's hope that doesn't really expand. But thank you very much for joining us. That's the author of Geek Nation. The book is called How Indian Science is Taking Over the World. That's Angela Saini. Thank you very much for coming into Midori House. We'll be back to talk about the Japanese film industry after this.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes, and quips of the week, tune into The Curator every Sunday right here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest to the week in world affairs, business, culture, and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, hosted by me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a show about making things better, Each week, I'll take you on a rollicking romp through the worlds of design, craft, architecture, fashion, and graphics, with factory frolics, building tours, product tests, and studio guests.
They're beautiful, they're functional. When you use them, they are completely poetic. They lift that activity, whatever it is, to another level. It makes you aware of the quality of what you're doing.
Tune in every week to hear the stories behind the things that we live with. That's Section D, premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, 49 minutes past the hour, 11 minutes to the top of the hour. Now, this week, London's Institute for Contemporary Arts is hosting a Japanese film festival called Whose Film Is It Anyway?, showcasing new works and highlighting the concept of originality in Japanese cinema. Well, it's usually focusing on Tokyo Story and Godzilla. If they're your ideas of Japanese cinema, then apparently Whose Film Is It Anyway? Will surprise you. Joining us on the line to discuss this and Japanese film in general is writer and film curator Jasper Sharp. Good afternoon from London here, Jasper.
Hello there.
Now tell us the highlights of this year's festival. What can we look forward to?
Oh, no, it's a big programme. Actually, a lot of it happened over the weekend already, so I'm not quite sure what's left, but the I mean, obviously there's the London dates, but it's touring around the rest of the UK as well. For me, I think the highlight was a director called Masayuki Suo, who was pretty big about 15 years ago. He made a film called Shall We Dance, a comedy about ballroom dancing, which got remade in Hollywood with Richard Gere. We showed his latest film, I Just Didn't Do It, which is quite a damning indictment of the Japanese judiciary system.
Mm. Now, sounds interesting. How's that gone down in Japan? Do we know?
Well, the focus of this season was to look at basically films that you said modern, but I mean basically films that were made in the past 10 years. So this film came out about 5 years ago, and it did go down very well because it pointed all the flaws in the system, and ended up with Suo actually ending up on a government advisory board. So actually, it was quite interesting for a director that's come from this very sort of comedy drama background, that's making films which are very socially engaged, and basically a campaign film that's actually had a lasting effect.
Mm. So how is Japanese cinema changing? I mentioned in the introduction, you know, Ozu's Tokyo Story, then people have seen Godzilla or maybe the Ringu films. Where are we going with in Japanese cinema?
Well, the interesting thing about Japanese cinema is, of course, it's there's about 400 to 500 films coming out every year. And so with such sort of vast volume, there's quite a lot of room for variation within the genre. So really, it's difficult to notice a change. I mean, certainly there was this thing pre-millennium where everything was quite pessimistic and sort of suffering from the aftershocks of the Ohm sarin gas attacks and the Hanshin earthquake. And it was getting quite frivolous and hedonistic in recent years. Films like Memories of Matsuko and Kamikaze Girls. I think it's too early to be seen at the moment what's going to happen after the the Fukushima incident last year and the Tohoku earthquake.
Yes.
But I can imagine it's going to have quite a profound effect on the national cinema.
Well, I haven't noticed that fewer films are being made.
Certainly, I think there was a case, and as well, there was quite a big sort of distribution snarl-up as well. A lot of films that did get released went on quite a limited release. I mean, there were less cinemas around in Japan for a while. I mean, one of the most interesting things about Japanese cinema, I think, is because they're made on quite a modest budget and there's quite a fast turnaround with production, that there's always, they get made quick enough to react to whatever the actual media talking point there is there. So I think they've actually got a quite a good pulse on what's going on in Japan at the moment. So it's quite easy to read Japanese culture through its cinema.
And what's your take on Japanese cinema goers? What do they prefer to watch these days?
Oh, well, I think this is one of the motivations for the season is that unfortunately that the top grossing films are all TV tie-ins and sort of quite frivolous You know, so there was a film called Rookies, I think, which was all about a baseball team. Umizaru about a scuba diving sort of rescue guard service. A lot of animation. I mean, this is the really popular end of Japanese cinema. And the sort of stuff that we usually see over in the West isn't quite so populist, because I don't think this very popular brand of TV tie-ins or manga tie-ins really has much resonance with Westerners. We obviously get a very similar, a different side in terms of horror and sci-fi, more cult titles. But I think this is really the general motivating sort of idea behind this Japan Foundation season, is to show the sort of in-between stuff, the sort of dramas that really just look at everyday Japanese people's lives. And obviously we said, whose film is it anyway? This film is based on, you know, its directors working from original material as opposed to novels or mangas or TV series.
Well, you mentioned mangas and anime. That's still going strong and very well in cinemas from Tokyo to Osaka to Nagoya.
Yes, I mean, there's always these pre-existing franchises. Doraemon's a big one, Detective Conan, the Pokemon even. I mean, you usually get sort of one of these, you know, the theatrical version of a film of popular TV manga characters once a year for the holiday season, and they obviously get the children's audience and do pretty well at the box office. Manga's sort of interesting. I mean, you know, it's so diverse, the sort of films which are, well, so the whole source material, graphic novels out in Japan at the moment. So when a film says it's sort of based on a manga, you can't really make any assumptions about its content at all. Mm. You know, it could be one of any type of genre.
Indeed. Okay, well, thank you very much, Jasper. The film festival is on London's ICA, and there are films on every night for the next few nights. But thank you very much. That was Jasper Sharp joining us on the line there. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é Monocle 24.
Now, there's no escaping Valentine's Day as we move to the end of February the 14th here in Europe. And while some may loathe the date, Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, analyses his relationship with the day.
It's Valentine's Day today. Commercial nonsense. Smug couples sat at tables for two, trying to outdo each other in various tableaux of domestic bliss. Cheap cards, expensive flowers, too much perfume. Schmaltzy little gifts, hugging teddy bears, helium balloons with leering grins and feet, cheeky cupids with blushing cheeks and mildly suggestive arrows. Yes, today has been, or will be, depending where you are in the world, filled with all of these and much more. I know what you're thinking. Here comes another annual staple of Valentine's Day, the whiny, moaning opinion piece. Today you won't be able to open a newspaper without finding a bitchy, bile-filled commentary about how Valentine's Day is an entirely unnecessary waste of time, money and emotion. Clichés about clichés. I'm more sick of these opinion pieces than I am of any public displays of affection. Valentine's bashing is such a 90s pastime. It belongs in the decade that gave us sassy, empowered singletons talking openly and loudly about their numerous sexual conquests over expensive cocktails. It's too easy to imagine the bitter, single hack, hunched over his or her laptop, bemoaning the smug artifice of Valentine's Day. I definitely don't want to talk about Sex and the City, but I know that you were thinking about that anyway. Nauseating, annoying, and outdated. Of course, now I'm playing into another predictable hole, moaning about the moaners. And so, in celebration of Valentine's Day, I'm going to finish my moan early and tell you why I love it. I like watching girls and boys master the art of carrying flowers awkwardly on their commute, feeling the envious eyes of fellow passengers burning holes in the backs of their heads, whilst radiating mixed emotions of shame and elation. I like the unlikely queues of teenagers and office workers piling into newsagents to buy the card they forgot to give their other half first thing in the morning. Similarly, I love the overheard snippets of increasingly frantic attempts to find a table for two for dinner. I like how twee it is that a Valentine's special menu will always come with two glasses of pink Prosecco, oysters and chocolate fondant for pudding. It's the chef's attempts to make couples old and new squirm with embarrassment. But actually, it's quite cute. Bars, restaurants and pubs the world over are full tonight, either with couples hamming it up or playing it down, or groups of single friends drowning their sorrows. Let's face it, even the unattached masses who claim to hate Valentine's Day take full advantage of their freedom by celebrating with friends. And they all harbour a small glimmer of hope that today might just be the day they meet someone special to spend it with next year. I am one of them, but I love Valentine's Day because I am a romantic. Unless I meet someone today who likes me so much that they decide to take me out to dinner tonight, I will be taking my oldest friend, who's also single, out for a meal. I won't feed him oysters, he's allergic to them, but we will have a gay old time that won't involve sneering at the couples all around us. It's too easy to be miserable, and there's enough happening in the world to lower our spirits without seeking it out. There we go. I heart Valentine's Day, and so should you.
Well, we're out of time for this Monday edition of Midori House. Today's show is produced by Dawn Trump, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. I'll be back at 2200 hours London time with the Monocle Daily, which we will kick off the day in Asia. Next on Monocle 424 is Section D with Hugo MacDonald. But from me, Ted Kravitz, for now, thanks very much for listening. It's goodbye.